Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international destination and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the gastronomic and economic virtues of a location. This week, we are switching things up a bit and looking at several food and drink destinations and using the 2014 Savoir Culinary Travel Awards as our guide. And to help me dissect the awards, I am joined by Betsy Andrews, Executive Editor of Savoir Magazine. Welcome, Betsy.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us here on Heritage Radio this morning. Very excited to have you here. So before we really dive into this year's awards, I want to go all the way back in time to last year. Savoir's first edition came out in 1994, yes. So happy 20th anniversary.
Thank you so much.
But the CTAs, the Culinary Travel Awards, didn't premiere until last year.
Yes.
So what was the idea behind launching the Culinary Travel Awards?
Well, it's simply the fact that this is what we do, right? We do culinary travel all over the world, and it just made sense for us to start recognizing the places, the destinations, the hotels, the bars, and the airlines that we travel on, the cruise lines that really exemplify the best of culinary travel. I mean, we can't keep these things a secret anymore.
And I do love that it is very travel-oriented in the sense that it does have those travel components that you can't do without, the airlines, the hotels, all of those little things, just besides just the great restaurants and,
that's right.
And bars.
Anyone who's, taking a long flight like we do really appreciates actually fine service on an airline, and, more and more you're seeing that, so that's terrific.
And how does it work? How do you come up with the categories? How are the winners chosen?
So the editors came up with the categories. These are the things that just made sense to us. And we have added more categories this year, and we'll continue to add more as we build out the awards. And then we come up with lists. We get together with expert travelers. We have all sorts of contributors to the magazine, our Virtuoso Travel Board. These are our travel agents all over the world who specialize in this kind of thing. And they help us create a list. And then we also go to our readers who vote on their favorites as well.
Fun. So I want to focus on a couple of categories today. Let's start from the top. The best international culinary destination,
yes.
Large. So
yes.
A lot of contenders here, obviously. Paris and Melbourne got some nods, but Hong Kong came out on top. So what makes Hong Kong the top culinary destination?
Well, Hong Kong is one of those extremely interesting cities. It's an East meets West city. There are Western chefs who have opened very fine dining restaurants all over Hong Kong, primarily in hotels. Gordon Ramsay's going to open there soon. Jamie Oliver just opened. Jean-George Van Richten. Grey Coons. There's even, sort of on the more street level, there's a very popular Yardbird for chicken yakitori. That's a couple from Canada that opened that place. And then there is the sort of native cuisine of Hong Kong, which is Cantonese. And this is what's really interesting to me, this fantastic, fantastic tradition of Chinese food there. It's exemplified in the finest dining by a 3-star Michelin restaurant, which is called Lung King Hin. And there you get very traditional and yet really impeccable and fine Cantonese food, things like crispy eel with, a sweet mustard sauce, or lobster in a fermented bean sauce, a fantastic roast goose with plum sauce, and the service is impeccable. The food is exquisite. There's also really innovative Chinese food happening now. There's a restaurant called Bo Innovation where the chef does something called extreme Chinese cuisine, and it's sort of sculptural. It's very playful. It's almost performance art. I think one of the funnest dishes there is something called baby food. And he deconstructs a popular street food, which is a spam and egg sandwich. And he turns the spam into a foam. He does a soft-boiled egg there, croutons, and just to gild the lily, make it fine dining, black truffles, and he serves it all in a baby food jar.
That sounds amazing. And I saw last week that they just got 3 stars from Michelin. They joined Lung King Hain as another destination in Hong Kong. I think three restaurants with 3 stars now. And do you think Hong Kong's going to keep pushing the envelope? We're going to see more of that innovation keep growing? Or
I do think so. And I think some of that will be, like I said, on the street level. There will also continue to be that really traditional, wonderful, you know, Dai Pai Kong, which is just street stall food and fresh seafood and, mm-hmm. you know, noodles and dumplings and great dim sum. I think we have not yet exhausted the possibilities there. It's an interesting time in Hong Kong, so
absolutely.
We'll see what's going on
with the current events and seeing if some of these trends kind of migrate to mainland China.
Absolutely.
I'm going to have Fuchsia Dunlop on in a couple weeks, so I'll have to ask her. Something tells me she'll know.
Very interesting. That'll be great.
And I think Hong Kong, what's so great, it was what makes it such a complete ecosystem of a culinary destination, is that it does touch all the points. It does touch street food. It does have the markets. It has the high end. It's forward thinking. And so I think that's why probably it definitely came out on top.
Sure. There are 11,000 restaurants in 500, square kilometers. It's not a big space, and it's just filled with food.
All right. Well, let's jump continents. Let's head to South America. Mm-hmm. São Paulo also gets a nod for this category. And, Brazil is blowing up in a lot of ways, whether it's the economy, arts, sporting events. So it's not surprising that food has become a big thing there as well. So why São Paulo?
Well, São Paulo is an enormous city. There are 20 million people there, and it is extremely diverse. So you get cuisine from all over the world and some very interesting and, if you don't know the city, unexpected things. Like, there's the largest Japanese population outside of Japan there, so there's impeccable sushi. There's also a very big Italian component there and an Italian community. And some people like to say that there's better pizza in Sao Paulo than there is in Naples. And some of that is really innovative, right? So you'll have a pizza that's, smoked and buffalo mozzarella, some fresh herbs, and then they'll put persimmon on it as well. But for Brazilian cuisine, I think the man that put this city on the map is Alex Atala, of course, at GOM. And for 13 years, he's been doing, beautiful but really innovative food. And, when we talk about diversity, if we talk about the most diverse place in Brazil and, in fact, the world, if we're going to go beyond humans, it's the Amazon. And so Alex Atala has taken indigenous Amazonian ingredients, some of them pretty wild, things like, a raw Amazonian ant on a dish, or jambu leaf, which sort of numbs your mouth as you eat it. But he's making very beautiful and, in fact, approachable food with those ingredients.
Fascinating. And so it's kind of, they have a rich tradition of course with their history and all of those populations coming over, the Italians, the French, the Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And so that nice kind of balance of the history with the biodiversity and what's kind of on the ground there,
right,
making
right.
it really, really interesting and fascinating
right.
and exciting.
And then, of course, you can always go to sort of a working day lunchroom and eat like this amazing feijoada, which is the Brazilian national dish, pork and beans stew.
Excellent. Well, let's narrow it down a little bit and look at the top culinary destination for a smaller population, about 800,000 people or less. Copenhagen, expert's choice, not surprising. But I want to concentrate more on Tel Aviv. Actually, let me go back before we get there. What happens when Noma, the best restaurant in the world, from the smaller city goes to Tokyo in January, and you have this small meets large kind of superfood giant?
That's going to be pretty exciting, isn't it?
It is. I think everyone's kind of holding their breath waiting to see what happens. It's a big experiment, but It's going to be...
Yeah, but I think it's absolutely going to work. I mean, there is there's a similarity in the exquisiteness of the ingredients and the perfection of technique in these two places, and the love of seafood. I think that's really going to work.
Well, all the people who get to eat there are very, very lucky, very fortunate. So I got ahead of myself. Let's go back, talk about Tel Aviv. Why is Tel Aviv such an exciting food destination right now?
You know, it's always been exciting, and well, here's a little story. I'll tell you why. I have a friend who is from Tel Aviv, and you know, she tells me when I was a kid, like when I was a kid, I'd eat, you know, Doritos and Jolly Ranchers for a snack. What did she snack on? Like a little sweet Persian cucumber. You know, so there's amazing produce there. I mean, this is a country that just, wow, it's abundant. And that has really, I think, made the street food incredible. The market's incredible. And also just the use of vegetables in the restaurants is amazing. I mean, you get, you know, a restaurant like Abraxas North, where the chef, El Alshani, might serve you a paper bag. And inside there might be like very lightly cooked string beans, just tossed with garlic and olive oil and salt and a little lemon, and it's just exquisite, and it's very simple, and you're really happy about it. It's also really a melting pot city. So there's an enormous pan-Arabic influence there. You know, you go to Old Jaffa and eat hummus for breakfast in the morning, and that's really wonderful. And there's sort of the Yemeni tradition of offal that you're starting to see in restaurants, too. Meir Adonai, who is another celebrity chef, he has a very elevated restaurant called Katit, and then he just opened a couple of years ago a more sort of rough and tumble, more sandwichy place called Mizlala, and he's doing things like fried calves brains on croissant and putting pork in his kugel. It's pretty
really special. Something sounds like, you know, you can get it there.
Yeah. And, you know, Tel Aviv is it's a beach town. It's really casual. There's lots of cafes, people spilling out into the streets at night, old people drinking coffee. Much of it is the vibe as well.
Absolutely. Food in context always tastes a little bit better.
Yes.
Well, you brought up the produce and you brought up Jaffa. So Tel Aviv also got a nod for the best international market and shops category in the CTAs. So what makes a great market?
A great market is one that has incredible diversity, but also lots of street food. So, you know, the two notable markets in Tel Aviv, the biggest is Shuk HaKarmel, where you can get all sorts of really delicious pita sandwiches and incredible fresh ingredients and spices. And then the Yemeni Quarter is right there as well, if you want to, you know, get like
some of that awful street food that you were just talking about.
Calves foot soup. And then there's also the Winsky Market, the spice market, which was founded by Greeks, and then a lot of Turks moved in. If you want to get the best burekas, you know, anywhere around, they're there. And also incredible spices, pickles, sorts of things like that.
Do you think that there's a natural correlation between great food destinations for restaurants and also having great markets? Like, is it a chicken and egg thing where you have the farmers and you have the suppliers that have this wonderful produce and the chefs kind of feed off of that? Or do the chefs come first and then they say, let's have this, let's grow this, let's taste this?
Sure. Well, of course, you know, the chicken begets the egg, begets the chicken, begets the egg.
Exactly.
So, you know, chefs need inspiration and they find it at the street level. And they find it in markets, and they find it at farms. And then those farmers need to have somebody buying their products. And they also need direction. You know, what are chefs cooking with now? What are chefs interested in? And they will grow for chefs. So these things completely feed each other.
Wonderful. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be taking a look at some more categories from Savora's 2014 Culinary Travel Awards.
You are listening to Spicy Peanuts by Evan Hashi on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we are back. I am Brianna Kurtz. You are listening to Native on Heritage Radio, and we are still chatting with Betsy Andrews from Savoir Magazine. So we talked about all these great food destinations and markets in the first half, but I'm thirsty, so let's talk about drinks. Best Cocktails and Drinks International. London took the category. So what does the drink scene look like in London? Is it classics? Is it experimentation? Is it a hybrid? Because you bring up some of these places, Duke's, American Standard, these really, like, they're doing the classics really well.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When you ask people from London, even drinks writers from London, they'll say, well, you know, we're not really drinking that many cocktails in London. Me and my, you know, pals still get along. A bunch of blokes, you know, we get around, get together and just drink beer. However, there is some of the most innovative cocktail culture there in the entire world. You know, of course, there are the classics. You go to Duke's, which was founded in 1908, and you drink, you know, the martinis or the Vespers that, you know, Ian Fleming's James Bond drank. Same thing with the Savoy, you know, at the Savoy Hotel, the American bar. Many of our classic cocktails were devised there. But then there's somebody like Tony Conigliaro, right, who's just a hero of mine, you know. He does gastromolecular, you know, approaches to cocktails. He's doing things like one of his signature drinks, the Prairie Oyster, where he makes a sort of a tomato yolk. And then he has an infused horseradish vodka. He's mixing that with sherry, shallots, pepper sauce, salt, you know, celery salt, and all sorts of micro herbs on top. It is an astounding, improbable drink that also is the greatest riff on the Bloody Mary that you've ever heard of.
It sounds like the...
and then there's Alex Cretagna. And his cohort over I'm forgetting the name of the bar at Artesian. I'm so sorry. And he as well is making all sorts of really interesting drinks using things like smoke and all sorts of esoteric liquors. You know, then there are just a few regular old great night, you know, late night places for a classic martini or a Bramble in London. I think we are going to see a lot more of that highfalutin drink coming there. I think that Tony Conigliaro has really inspired a generation of mixologists.
Well, it sounds like no short of options for a place to grab a great cocktail in London town. And then two other cities I want to mention in this category, Melbourne and Sydney got nominated. So I think it's interesting that you have two cities, obviously, from the same country, different with different food scenes. But what is going on in Australia and how are these cities different?
So I'd say Melbourne is, you know, is San Francisco to Sydney's New York. You know, Sydney is a really big cosmopolitan city, really diverse people, lots of busy things going on, lots of glamour. Melbourne is more of a farm-to-table city. The Yarra Valley is right there, so this incredible wine country, really analogous to Napa Valley. There's a lot of really terrific sort of bistro dining. But there's as well some terrific cocktails there. There is a sort of a speakeasy scene happening there, and actually there's at least, you know, one place that is shared that has a location both in Melbourne and in Sydney, and that's Eau de Vie, where you can get a cocktail Dave Gustafson menu, you know, where it's just whiskey cocktails, a whole menu of whiskey cocktails, a flight of whiskey cocktails, which is really, really lovely. There are other places that are sort of hidden in speakeasy, like Bar Empire. And behind Bar Empire is the Gin Palace that has hundreds of kinds of gin, and specializing in gin there. You get that as well in Sydney, though. You get these bars that are really specializing in one type of spirit or wine in just an enormous amount of volume. So Baxter Inn in Sydney has over 300 kinds of whiskey. Barrio Chino has over 70 kinds of tequila. 121 BC, which is very popular, you know, only specializes in Italian wines.
Do you think that there's a healthy level of competition kind of bouncing back and forth between Sydney and Melbourne, that they feed off one another?
I do. I think that there's a cross-fertilization and maybe a little bit of a competition as well.
That's good for the consumers. They get the fruits of the labor kind of to benefit from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when you have a really sophisticated wine culture like you do in Australia, that actually always brings, you know, beer to the table and cocktails to the table, and also international wines. And it also elevates the food, you know, and I think when you look at San Francisco, you see that as well, where you have really, you know, terrific wines, you've got to have great food to eat. So that's, you know, one reason we have such terrific cuisine as well in Australia and those cities.
Yeah, and they're definitely having a little bit of a wine renaissance right now too, so that's exciting.
They are, like every place else in the world, the wine is getting more refined and also more diverse.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's flip it, move on a little bit. The whole show we've been talking about international destinations, mm-hmm. So let's bring it home. But instead of talking about the categories individually, I kind of just want to look at the U.S. as a whole right now, and just in keeping the awards in mind, what trends are we seeing in the U.S. right now? What is Savor excited about?
Well, you know, it varies a little bit in different places. I think one thing, if we're talking about New York City, it's really been exciting in the past few years for us to get good Mexican food here in this town.
Finally! I had some Mexican street food yesterday morning for breakfast in Queens, and some Ecuadorian food as well, but... Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, there's Empellón. He's just about to open. He's opening this taco place. And that's going to be really, really exciting for Tacos Al Pastor, which is that Lebanese-Mexican fusion taco. You take a pork and you sort of make it like, you shave it like shawarma, and you put some pineapple on there, and it's fantastic. Another really exciting thing happening with Mexican food in New York, mm-hmm. is that Enrique Olvera from Pujol, which is, you know, on the San Pellegrino list of the best restaurants in the world, a really innovative, fantastic chef from Mexico City, is coming to New York and opening a place over near the High Line.
Opening this month, I think.
Yeah.
My roommate's actually from Mexico City, so she's really excited about that, because she's been complaining about not having good Mexican food in New York for years. And when she goes home, she's, you know, so happy. But she's definitely, we were having that conversation the other night about Enrique's restaurant opening. So
yeah, it's exciting.
Wonderful. What else in the U.S.? Down south, out west?
Sure. So Los Angeles, you know, they've had a drought. So ice cream's been really, really big there.
It's been a heat wave right now, too.
Yeah, it's been a heat wave. So, you know, people have been eating, you know, all sorts of different ice creams. There's a great place called Honey Me in Koreatown where you get a milk soft serve topped with a honeycomb. And then also there's been the downtown revitalization of the Grand Central Market, which is an historic market where you could always get like a good, you know, homey, a Mexican or, you know, Asian, you know, sort of lunch or breakfast. But now all these more, you know, these newer, more innovative places are moving in. You're getting great ice cream there as well. You're getting Lox and Bagels from Wexler's Deli. You're getting Egg Slut, which has terrific burgers. So everybody's sort of flocking there. And I also think that farm to table is really happening. You know, really popular place in Silver Lake, Squirrel, and also in Brentwood, Farm Shop. These places are bringing a little bit more of a San Francisco sensibility to Los Angeles. And, you know, then also I think it's always really exciting in Portland, Oregon. One thing that's happening in Portland, which is interesting, is a sort of a Russian thing.
Ooh, I was about to ask, are we finally moving on from farm to table a little bit, or who's starting to move, you know, past that and into the next phase?
Uh-huh. Well, I don't think that we've yet seen the end of that, but I think people are taking farm to table and sort of to new levels, mm-hmm. elevating it a little bit more. And still using farm to table in a diversity, and also using it in a diversity of cuisines. It's not just a sort of American idiom now. So, you know, the same chefs are opening international restaurants, but they're doing it with the same impeccable ingredients. So the Russian thing, you know, Vitaly Pali has this pop-up called Danette, where he's doing Russian cuisine. And, of course, he is of Russian background. And then there's another really popular place there called Kachka that's getting a lot of attention. And also pop-ups have come to Portland. So there's they're happening in all sorts of different places there. And wood-fired cuisine. You know, Vitaly Pelli is a big guy with this, but giant rigs, you know, making incredible grilled foods, a very lusty food. There's a lot of foraging going on there. Truffles, Argan truffles are finally, they figured out if they have dogs hunt for them, they're going to be ripe and they're going to be delicious. So now you're starting to really see people working with a lot of fungi there.
Taking local to an elevated level,
yes.
for sure.
Yes.
Well, I just saw that the October fall edition of Savoir hit stands. Was it this week? Last week? I just saw it came out.
Yes.
Okay. What can readers expect to find in this issue?
The October issue has...
The November issue.
Right. It's the November issue. It's the November issue. Okay. Yes. It's the Thanksgiving issue that just hit the stands. So... the big story in that issue is a Thanksgiving meal that Thomas Keller wrote the story. His staff at Bouchon serves every year for a group of American veterans who are in a program in Yountville. Actually has one of the largest populations of American veterans in that town, in the whole entire country. And on the cover of the issue is not a turkey, it's a ham. A beautiful glazed spiral ham. You know, in the down south, the American South, the ham has always been sort of an alternative to the turkey. You always get the ham on the table as well. And lately, people are talking about the turkey as an alternative roast for Thanksgiving. Why, you know, turkey's wonderful, but why should we only have turkey?
Well, I was really excited to see it. The India issue was amazing, but I'm always like ready for the next one. So I was so excited this week when I was visiting my news store. So, all right. Well, we're about out of time. Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savoir Magazine, thank you so much for joining me today and talking about the Savoir Culinary Travel Awards, hashtag Savoir CTA. That's all for Native this week. Be sure to join me next week when I'll be talking to Chef George Mendes of Aldeia. We will be chatting about all things Portugal, including his new book, wait for it, My Portugal. See you then.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.